taxation across the year. Well, there is a very important question in Earth geology, and that is, what is the origin of the granite which makes up the continents of the Earth? They have been arguing over that for 100 years. It's not because there is no mechanism known that can generate granite, it's because there are two mechanisms known, either of which can generate granite. You can get it by primary melting of the planet, that is to say, you let the planet melt, you let the various substances in it separate out by weight, the flayed stuff floats to the top and forms a crust, and that crust can very easily be granite. You can do this in a smaller portion of the planet as well, which is why we know that some granite can originate this well. Another completely different way that you can get granite is by taking a pile of sedimentary rock, sandstone, limestone, shale, things like that, get it down far enough into the Earth that the internal heat of the Earth melts them, then let them re-solidify, and lo and behold, what you get is granite. Geologists can take you out into the field and show you specific granites which are known to have formed by the first mechanism, and other specific granites which are known to have formed by the second. But in most cases, it is not possible to tell. And so the question is, which of those two mechanisms is the most important? Which is the one that was dominantly responsible for forming the granite that the continents that we walk on and we dig our minerals out of are made of? When we went to the other planets, we had a major shock, first on the Moon, and then on Mercury and Mars. And that is that although all those planets have a division of the crust into two kinds of rocks, one of which is basalt, and the other of which is lighter than basalt and sticks up above the basalt, and therefore forms structures analogous to the Earth's continents. In none of those other cases is that rock granite. In the case of the Moon, it is a rock which is relatively rare on the Earth called anorthosite. And anorthosite is much closer related chemically to basalt than granite is. Granite is a totally different kind of rock. Anorthosite is a modification of basalt. It's not basalt, it's lighter than basalt, but it's closely related to it. So all of those planets are differentiated, which is the term for a planet which is made of different kinds of rock, and therefore we've got to figure out what the mechanisms were that separated out the one from another. But those planets are less differentiated than the Earth is, and they do not have granite. Why? Well, if the former mechanism is correct, the one that you just get granite by primary melting and the original differentiation by density of the planet back when it melted at the beginning of solar system history, then granite can originate on a planet that does not have water. And the reason these other planets don't have granite is presumably just that they are smaller than the Earth, requires water first, even if this is a thin crust of some sort, etc. That doesn't change that statement. You need miles and miles of thickness of the stuff to create granite by this mechanism in the sort of amounts that granite exists in the continent. And that could happen only if there was liquid water to lay it down. And that could happen only on a planet where there's liquid water, and therefore the reason those other planets don't have them has nothing to do with their size, is they don't have liquid water. Do you see why Venus is the important test case? Venus is the only other planet that is as big as the Earth, but it does not have liquid water. So if there is granite on Venus, then we know the answer to one of the most difficult and important questions in Earth's geology, and that is, what is the origin of the granite to make up our continent? Here are the data that we have. These are the radioactivity measurements made by Venera 8, Venera 9, and Venera 10 compared with the numbers for Earth granite and Earth basalt. The numbers for Venera 9 and Venera 10 are very similar in both cases to basalt. And you will recall that the densities measured by their densitometers were also similar to basalt. Furthermore, the rocks look like basalt. So it is almost certainly the case that those rocks are of basaltic composition. Now, if they are, if that soil is ground up basalt and then somehow that gets cemented together again to form sedimentary rock, it's still basaltic composition. It started as originally basaltic material. And I don't think you'll be surprised after what I've told you so far to find a star on Venus after all you have on every other of the inner planets. I'm surprised you believe you didn't have. But the interesting set of data is the radioactivity measurement from Venera 8. That is way too high for basalt and is at least somewhat similar to granite on the Earth. Now that's the only piece of information that we have. One spacecraft out of three landed at a single point on the surface of Venus and made a measurement not even of the composition of the rock, but just its radioactivity, and got data that are comparable to granite. If it turns out from subsequent investigation by other spacecraft that indeed there is granite on Venus, that would be one of the most important discoveries in the space age. As it is now, this is exciting. It makes us want to have more data, and someday we may very well get them, but nobody is going to go make major planetological theories as a result of three numbers which are somewhat similar to three numbers of Earth granite. It's just too important a question. So the moral of the story is don't go taking it for granted yet. We will not get this kind of information from Pioneer Venus, which, as I told you, is primarily an atmospheric mission, but in addition to the fact that the Americans are going to launch two spacecraft towards Venus this summer, which will get there in December, there is every reason to believe that the Russians will do the same thing. And presumably they would be at least as sophisticated as Venera 9 and 10, which means that they would have densitometer measurements as well. They're still not capable of doing chemical composition, which Venera 9 and 10 weren't. And I would be very surprised if they can dream up any way of doing it when you've only got an hour or so. You know, but at least you can measure density and radioactivity and take pictures of the rock. And one of these days, if there are indeed structures on Venus that are similar to the Earth's continent, sooner or later, by blind chance, and that's how they pick their landing sites, we don't know where they're landing on Venus, we don't know anything about the surface. But sooner or later, they would happen to come down by blind chance in one of the magnetic areas. In the meanwhile, Pioneer Venus will get some indirect information by making those altimetry observations. And if it turns out, in fact, that there are large blocks of highlands and large blocks of lowlands, you can get some notion of what the density of the highlands are by seeing how high they stick up above the lowlands, if you make the assumption the lowlands are indeed basalt. So I think you see, in conclusion, that today's lecture was much more speculative, much more tentative, much more inferential than last week. That's because we know not nearly as much about the surface and interior of Venus as we do about its atmosphere. But there are some very exciting things that we have learned, and some even more exciting things that we are clearly pointing in the direction of learning, if not by Pioneer Venus, some of them will, some of them won't, then by other, perhaps subsequent Russian spacecraft. And it's a very exciting sort of thing, and I wanted to share it with you, even though there are a lot of places where we don't know the answers. Thank you very much. Now, once again, we have, let's see, it's 7 minutes after 9 by my clock and 7 minutes after 9 by the one in the back there. And so we have a fairly extended time for questions. We can stay until 9:30, I am told. So let's give people a chance to leave. There are handouts in the back. Once again, we have the mimeograph schedules of astronomical events at the University of Michigan and Southeastern Michigan. We also have the sky calendar from East Lansing, which we ran out of last time. So if you didn't get one of those last time, you wanted, be sure to grab one now. If any of you are going to any of my lectures at Michigan State University in East Lansing, be sure to grab not only the white mimeograph full-page schedule, but the yellow half-page, which is the update for East Lansing only. The yellow one is right, the white one is wrong. I beg your pardon. There is also a large stack of, well, last time there was a small stack of, that is information on the L5 Society, which is interested in space colonization. So the book, the space colonization books, are not in yet. We are racing against time, and we have great hope that they will come in time for you to buy them if you're interested after the lecture next time. Otherwise, there is a sign-up sheet. You can put your name on the list. Yeah.
I told you last week about SGW with the reflections off the polar cap, calling a moon on them. Is today, WJR, J.P. Kearney, watching the moon set and decaying it, noticing the blackness, the reddening and all that. Announced, you know, well, he doesn't know what caused it, but it was beautiful. Some fellow called in, identified himself as an amateur astronomer from Detroit, and said that's because when the moon sets, it goes into the Earth's penumbra, and when it rises, it comes up. He announced to the world that that was
wonderful. With friends like this, and these enemies.
By the way, what's the IAU convention?
Montreal.
When?
79? August 14th to 24th of next year, 1979. But he's asking me is when the International Astronomical Union Convention next year is. That's the body of all the world astronomers, and they're meeting on this continent for the first time since 1961. And that is in Montreal. Okay, so let's get another question for us. Question is, where did I get the high-resolution versions of the Venera 9 pens, I assume you mean, in the May issue of Icarus, which is the Standing Solar System Journal, paper by the Russian, signed by Michael Kaldish, he's one of the academicians. I mean, he's a figurehead for that Russian report of their results. There's a more thorough discussion by a bunch of Russians and Dr. Uchano Ranka of Wayne State University, who has worked with the Russians extensively. He's the one that's responsible for this idea about the sevens that Dr. Ranka was telling me about. And that is in the bulletin of the Geological Society of America, and I don't know the exact date, but if you hunt back through the last few months of them, you find it. Okay? There's no way you could buy those slots.
Well, remember, the sulfuric acid itself doesn't make it down
right.
The surface.
Well, that's why I said the sulfuric.
Yeah.
It seems to be two traces that are otherwise quite different, 1,300 miles apart, too.
But if it is there, what can you do to green
them?
Is it increase its
intensity? The question is whether the fact that the surface is so black will change temperature gradients.
No, because all of the... Okay, not all of the sunlight is absorbed by the time we get to the surface, but virtually all of it is. For meteorological purposes, it is. In fact, for meteorological purposes, there's no further absorption of sunlight below about 30 miles. The reason the temperature keeps increasing is the pressure is still increasing. Okay. But, I think the answer to that is no, unless you were somehow able to strip away the clouds.
Okay.
You all assume the five-knot turn. Yeah, water is 8 times denser than Venus air, so maybe a little stronger.
Correct.
It seems to be very static. There are detailed models which are based on total ignorance of the chemical composition of Venus' atmosphere, other than carbon dioxide, that attempt to generate sulfuric acid. I didn't go into those models because we just don't know enough. We will get very detailed information on the trace constituents of Venus' atmosphere and Pioneer Venus. And it will go down through the clouds, make measurements all the way down, and we're going to know the things that are, less than one part per billion in that atmosphere after that mission is over. Then we ought to be able to answer questions about the mechanisms to generate it and dissipate it. But it seems quite obvious that it is a very static stuff, and at any given grotto is around for many years, if not more. And so the answer is, on a long time scale, yes, but on a long time scale, any constituent of any planetary atmosphere is destroyed by something that is regenerated by something else. If nothing else is lost in the space, the question is how long it takes. You know, the thing that it takes longer to age in the solar system, that's what the planet is about, that's an atmosphere, right? Or else the things that are regenerated fairly rapidly on the time scale of the age of the solar system. Same example of that latter is Mercury. Mercury has essentially no air. In fact, I said earlier it has no air, but it has about 1 trillionth as much air as the Earth. All right, if you want to call that an atmosphere, fine. It's a higher definition. The point is, it does have gas, which Mercury was able to detect in its blue hat. And the incredible thing about it was that gas was helium, which is so lightweight, and it's even such temperature at Mercury. That entire helium atmosphere is lost in the space and has to be replenished by time scale every 4 hours. Now, that sounds impressive until you remember how little helium has to replenish. But still, you've got to figure out mechanisms to do it. And it is the kind of argument as to whether it comes in from solar wind or whether it is replenished from outgassing of helium that's generated by radioactive decay in the rock. Side of the grid and then the
cleverly steered the conversation away from Venus, where we don't know the atmospheric chemistry, to Mercury, where we do. Okay.
Sir.
Yes, it certainly is.
That was just the point I was trying to make.
That it is very pretty, that when you are rain.
Well,
not
at
all.
When you have wind erosion on the Earth, and it's virtually impossible to find a geologic location where wind erosion dominates water erosion, only a few places like the certain deserts of Peru where it only rains once in every several hundred years. Otherwise, water erosion dominates. Even in the desert area in the southwest, you know, all those arches and so forth that people think were formed by wind, they weren't, they were formed by water. The water, there isn't much water out there, but when you get it, it's a flash flood. You know, so it's effective. And some of that morphology goes clear back to yesterday when there were nuclear lakes down there. Like Death Valley had a lake and it was 80 miles long and 900 feet deep. So you can go see the shoreline, call it Death Valley up on the side of the hill. It's very, very hard to study wind erosion on the Earth. And in fact, one of the things that geologists have been delayed about with lightning observations is that Mars is the first time we've had a chance to find a whole planet that is dominated by wind erosion and all the local erosion, water erosion, instead of the other way around, the like on Earth. But the answer to your question is, the term wind erosion and the term water erosion are both shorthand. The substances do not themselves do the erosion. The only major exception to that I can think of is that limestone, which is an important rock on Earth, is soluble in water, so they are literally in the water that does it. But ordinarily, and anyway, you call that erosion properly, we call that weathering. Ordinarily, when you use the term erosion, you are referring to particles that are carried by the substance in question, the wind or the water. And so the obvious, one obvious thing that's been looked at, and Rocco has done some thinking about this and so forth, is that if that cement is efficient, it's cemented down all the particles and the wind can't take them off. That sounds a little too good to be true. It just seems to me. I mean, certainly on Mars, there is cement at both of our landing sites, which is holding down the soil very, very well, to the point where even during the dust storm season last year, no changes whatever were seen. They got winds at 50 miles an hour, and that was not hundreds of miles an hour, which everybody was expecting, but kind of what dust storm really is, namely raising the dust only in certain places on the planet, and then diffusion of it all through the planet's atmosphere, not raising of it everywhere in the planet's atmosphere. But nevertheless, there were winds at 50 miles an hour, and there wasn't any change whatsoever in those, quote, sand dunes, end quote, that might go into one site, or even the smallest change in any of the features of either site. One change has been seen in any landscape in the entire Russian mission, and that was a place where 12 inches worth of sand, silt, in one of the so-called dunes, clumped and moved 18 inches. You know, nothing other than that. And yet, there is a world, so it's well cemented in place, and yet there is a world where there's a canyon 2,500 miles long, averaging half as deep as Mount Everest is high, averaging as far across from one end to the other as the Grand Canyon in Arizona is long, so was dug by wind. No. That's the answer. The Russians never tell us what they're going to do until they do it, but the Russians haven't even got a human being to the moon yet. As for Venus, well, you know, the problem is just so formidable that I think it's going to be a very, very long time before we're going to try to go around Venus. Mars, that's another story. I hope, in fact, that there is not a man landing on Mars any time in my lifetime anyway. Not for a century or more, perhaps never. And that's certainly not because I'm not in favor of a manned spaceflight. For example, I'd love to see an expedition going to orbit around Mars. But what we're trying to study on Mars is the activity in the surface. And I'm using the word activity deliberately, so I'm going to use the word life or non-life, because we don't know which it is. But either way, if it is a life that is very different from the kind we know on Earth, or if it is chemical activity that is very different from the kind we know on Earth and mimic life in many ways, either way, you want to leave that alone. And as soon as you have a man landing on the surface of Mars, you will contaminate the planet forever and ever with Earth bacteria, and we know that there are some bacteria that can live and reproduce in Martian conditions. So, you know, my answer to your question is I hope.
the case of Mars, not for a long time. In the case of Venus, there is no such objection. The temperature at the surface of Venus is considerably higher than the others that are used to sterilize the unmanned Viking landers, so they won't contaminate Mars. So the last problem we have there is contamination. There was a time when Carl Sagan dutifully published a paper, I mean dutifully, he was just trying to get all the possibilities in, about how there could be life up in the upper atmosphere, meaning where the temperature is a little more reasonable, and it could be floating around like balloons or something. But then we found out the clouds are made of sulfuric acid, so that's pretty well going back. And, well, not entirely. There are bacteria that live in sulfuric acid, but they evolved. They originated, you know, they evolved that way later. It's just that the technological problems can be overrun. I think Venus is going to be a great place for unmanned exploration for the foreseeable future.
What, Mars and life? Oh no, oh no. Not from Venus or Mars.
That's right.
Now you can make me believe anything about Jupiter. You know, but not Venus or Mars.
Jupiter is actually a very good place to go. As the weather is intelligent, well, you know, it hasn't come and visited us, but that doesn't mean it isn't down there. For most of the time there's been intelligent life on Earth, it would not have been detectable from space. It would not have been detectable from another planet, like radio waves or whatever. Jupiter has tremendous amounts of energy. It's hotter inside than, you get down inside and it's way too hot for life, but there's a level where the temperature would be just enough to support life. Plenty of water, methane, ammonia, which is the three basic substances that life believes were originated from on the Earth. There appear to be complex organic chemicals in Jupiter's atmosphere, enormous amounts of energy in the form of overactive lightning bursts. We don't know what the Jovian bathymetric bursts really are, but tremendous energy just from the chemical and the heat point of view. And there is no way of saying that life could have developed swimming in that atmosphere and that it could have developed any size or complexity to life. It may very well be that life in a terrestrial planet is a rather peculiar thing than where it actually really is in the universe of a building planet where the materials are and where the energy is. But of course, we have got a shred of that in favor of, you know, I'm saying you can't rule it out. But Venus and Mars, yeah, we can rule it out. No doubt about that.
Now, our impact velocity is of 60 miles per hour.
Right. So to compare a Martian dust storm with an Earth dust storm, you got to do much more complicated things like worrying about how much dust is actually going to be picked up by an inner atmosphere. And that's so complicated, we don't know how to do it.
But on Venus,
Venerian,
not Venusian.
Right. No such word as Venusian, or if there is, there shouldn't be. Venerian.
No, it doesn't really. And in fact, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that. That's part of the answer that the gentleman was asking about the wind erosion. It's almost like being hit by something underwater, you know. And in fact, Dr. Rocker was going to point that out to me also. The atmosphere itself cushions the impact. But, you got that power slope, right? So there's something that's breaking up rock, and something is making it move downhill. And something's doing it fairly recently. So I don't think we're going to do it recently in this context, but more recently than the formation of the human morphology of the center of Hempstead anyway. And there's also the point that there is such a thing as erosion under the sea. For example, there's a phenomenon called turbidity current, where you get a landslide, submarine landslide, coming off, for example, the edge of the continental shelf. And these produce enormous deposits down at the bottom of the continental shelf, which in fact someday, when Lake Atlantic takes its course, turn into the next generation of mountain ranges, that and the continental shelf itself. The fluvial part and the Piedmont part of the Appalachian are old turbidity current deposits for the most part on the ancient continental shelf. A turbidity current is a case where you start out with a landslide, and the falling sediment takes up a lot of water, which can't get out of its way, it's falling too fast, and the water itself then serves as a lubricant. And so it snowballs, it picks up, and picks up, and picks up, and those things can go 200 miles an hour. Every once in a while, it'll have wiped out an undersea cable. You know, so they know a good deal about the effects of turbidity currents. You can have similar sorts of things on things, especially on the hillside. So it seems, and of course where it happens in slow places, like for example, crater walls. Well, yeah, but the powers of now that's not a turbidity current deposit. I'm just saying that as an example of something that could destroy craters.
No.
The question is whether the asteroid wants a single planet. The answer is absolutely not. You can rule that on compositional grounds.
There are,
and I don't know if I explained differentiation. Yeah, of course, no, I didn't. That was just a lecture. I've given so many lectures this past month that it's very hard for me to remember what I said to which audiences. Differentiation means, in this case, gravitational differentiation, primary differentiation, means the planet melts and light stuff floats to the top, heavy stuff falls to the bottom, and so that sucks, right? And the Earth and the Moon center, all the large planets, according to theoretical calculations, have everything down to about 300 miles across, okay? So, if you see an asteroid which is made of some rock that is a product of differentiation, for example, basalt, then it must have once been part of a body of maybe 300 miles across. Okay? If you see an asteroid that is undifferentiated, and there's no such rock on Earth, we can calculate what it would be like, and in fact, they have meteoroids that are made of stuff, they're called carbonaceous chondrites, then it never was very much larger than it is now, if it's, you know, 10 or bigger than 300 miles across. The point is that you see both differentiated and undifferentiated asteroids in special studies made from the Earth. Now, in fact, there's a lot more evidence bearing on it, and it appears, well, for example, meteorites are probably fragments of asteroids. They're probably an asteroid belt. Certainly, the orbits that we have of meteorites that have been observed long enough, we can guess what the orbit was before it came into Earth's atmosphere, all have termini out there in the asteroid belt. So it appears that those are just little bits of asteroids that got their orbits perturbed and got thinned towards the Earth by, say, Jupiter's gravity, something like that. We can study those, and we know that many of them are indeed the fragments of once larger bodies, but in no case were those bodies bigger than 100 miles, a few hundred miles across. You can do that by studying the effect of cosmic rays it had on, all kinds of stuff. Details of what their pressure history has been and so on. And so apparently, the asteroids that we see today, the majority of them, in fact, this is a very recent discovery, the last few years, the majority of them are carbonaceous chondrite composition. And those, many of them, may very well have been not very much larger than they are today. But some of the asteroids that we see today are the product of fragmentation, presumably by collision, of bodies that were once larger but not the size of planets. There's another consideration too, which is you take every asteroid we've got and make a really generous estimate for the number of those that we don't see. So we haven't discovered anything that's too small, and you don't even get a decent size moon or a planet. Negligible amount of stuff.
And to account for a lot of the shells
that
around
them, is that possible? No, because for one thing, basalt itself is much younger than the period that you're talking about. The basalt keeps getting regenerated. If you mean was it going to be the origin of continents, well, first you gotta explain to me why it hasn't happened on any other planet. So you got this compositional difficulty. And second, there is the consideration that I oversimplify there a good deal. The granite that we see in the continents today is not left over unchanged since the formation of the Earth. There is no compositional difficulty. And second, there is the consideration that I oversimplify there a good deal. The granite that we see in the continents today is not left over unchanged since the formation of the Earth. There is no rock, not so much the pebble on the Earth, that is younger, that's older rather than 3.8 billion years, and the Earth is 4.6. So you've got almost a billion years there of change, of recycling of the rock, even within the continent. There's really more to it than I don't want. Getting back to your question about the asteroids, though, there's also some more evidence. First of all, if you had a population of fragments, you can calculate what the relative numbers of different sizes ought to be. Okay, and that calculation has been done, and it turns out that it matches the observed population of different asteroid sizes. So most of them are fragments of bodies that were once bigger, but in most cases not very much bigger. In many cases not even enough bigger that they're apparently differentiated. And finally, when you study asteroid orbits, it turns out they come in groups. There are about a dozen of them. They're called the Giordano family after the guy first discovered them.
And the party line is that each Hirayama family is the result of a breakup of a single parent body. Okay, we have time for about one more question. Yes. Several stars are much common than single stars like the sun. Well, it's possible. It's not where the other star went. Okay. Oh, I think it's possible. We have no reason to do it. We have no evidence for it. All right. We have a tiny bit of evidence, and this is very controversial, and it's really going off the deep end, and almost certainly isn't correct. I'll give it to you for what it's worth. Pulsars are the thing that rotates very rapidly, gives off radio waves every time it comes by, and so you get a very precisely timed set of beats, and it rotates very rapidly, so you get an awful lot of them, and you can measure its rotational velocity, which is ridiculous accuracy, you know, one part of 10 billion is easy. Okay, what that means is that very tiny changes can be detected. Well, all the pulsars are slowing down, and we think we know why that is, and they have to know more about what pulsars are for the reason. Taking the word for it, the pulsar normally slows down with age. And even though it slows down very little in a year, we can measure its period so precisely as you can measure that slowdown. There is one place in the sky where the pulsars seem not to be slowing down. All of them. And there are, I don't know, half a dozen of them in that direction. Now somebody suggested, no more evidence than that, the reason for it is that we are being accelerated towards that direction at just the right rate to compensate for the deceleration of the pulsar. In other words, we are moving in to meet the oncoming signal. If you know about Doppler shift, you understand that I'm really talking about the same phenomenon. And, okay, why are we being accelerated? Notice you require acceleration. A straight line velocity won't do it. You need acceleration because the pulsar is supposed to be changing their periods. And he says, well, okay, we were orbiting around some body, and by plugging in some rough numbers from the observed value of the acceleration that we aren't seeing, that's an observed value, from the unobserved value of the acceleration we aren't seeing, you can get a notion for the mass of the body and roughly where it is and so forth, and it's heavy enough that if it were a star, you know, it would be shining out there like a neon sun, the brightest thing in the sky, aside from the sun. And so he says, okay, fine, it's a black hole. You will note a tendency in modern astrophysics to explain everything that cannot be explained otherwise as a black hole. You know, quasars are black holes, and there are black holes in the center of galaxies, and there isn't enough mass in the universe to close the universe because 90% of the universe is black hole. You know, all this kind of stuff. Black holes are conveniently unobservable, and so, you know, it's very hard to shoot down these theories. So the idea is that we're orbiting around a black hole. Well, a black hole is a dead star, or at least one of that mass would be, and so in that case, you know, that'd be evidence of the sun being part of an original double star, too, but don't believe it. Because, I mean, that awfully fragmentary evidence to say something like that.
I was going to say we were made out of the nebula ejected from that star.
Oh, yeah, sure, when it became a supernova, right, absolutely. Okay, all fit together. Hey, we got to get out of here because it's 9:34. In fact, if you want to talk to me privately, though, we can do that as well. Up there.
Is this Donald Trump's
turn to keep up? No, this is not Donald Trump.